about countries as if they had clear individual personalities and a sort of strange Rousseau-esque general will. We say France was angry about the invasion of the Rhineland, or USA was getting suspicious of Russia, or whatever. And it's, of course, helpful shorthand, and without that we'd be obliged to qualify what we say all the time when talking about this type of affairs. But today, although of course I'll be using that shorthand and talking about France, when in fact I'm going to be talking about a lot of different groups of people, I want nonetheless to focus not so much on France and the Cold War world as on the French people and the Cold War world. And I want to think about different kind of overlapping responses to the international situation, particularly to France's loss of great power status after the Second World War. So I want to think about how the French, as diplomats, as politicians, as ordinary men and women, as businessmen, came to terms with this change in international status. How did they confront the new situation? Did they accept it? Did they defy it? Did they find ways of working within it? How did they feel about the newly increased dominance of America and also the USSR in European affairs? How did they want to situate themselves with regard to the great clash between the Cold War superpowers? How did they respond to the rebirth of their former German foe in also European politics? And would there be a place for national aspirations, for specifically French interests, within a new Europe, within some sort of European community? Well, to think about these questions, I want to start by raising a broad brush picture of France and the world in 1945, the sort of situation that France was in after the end of the Second World War with regard to other powers in Europe and elsewhere. And then I want to, as it were, take three case studies of French responses to this new situation. I want to think first of all about France and America, that very difficult relationship that we'll be looking at a little bit more tomorrow when we think about types of anti-Americanism in France, and about how the Americans and the French sought to work together, particularly with martial aid. Then I want to think about France and Europe, what different French visions were for France's role with regard to Germany, but also with regard to the European community, how a European vision could also be used to advance national interests or to oppose American dominance in Europe. So these are all intertwined. And then at the end, I want to think particularly about the Gaullist response, so thinking about de Gaulle's presidency from 1958 onwards, and his solution, as it were, to France's loss of great power status, which was to be so awkward on the international stage that nobody could avoid recognising France's position. So we'll think about that at the end. So I want to start by asking the question, well, where was France on an international level in 1945? Here we see one of the post-war meetings, looking at mutual boundaries of the world at Yalta in 1945, and you can see that France is actually not represented here. We've got Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin looking off in the distance there at the side. And many histories of this sort of post-war period, and particularly the beginning of the Cold War, talk about what one American senator, William Fulbright, described as two dogs chewing on the bone. And the two dogs here being the USA and the USSR, not even Churchill and Britain on the side there. Certainly, this is, in many ways, a justifiable picture of the emerging clash of superpowers in the 1940s and 50s. And we need to have that, we need to bear that in mind, the different aspirations of Russia and America. For Stalin, what was important for Russia because it lacked, he felt it lacked kind of natural boundaries, was to secure satellite states, obviously all the way around up to the Eastern Europe. So that was his idea of what Russia needed for security. I mean, obviously both America and Russia want security in this period, whereas for Americans, they conceive of their dominance not so much as these satellite states, but as what's been called a kind of empire by invitation, so an extension of American influence, particularly in Europe. And as Roosevelt's confidant, Harry Hopkins, expressed it in 1945, and this might seem to you to look slightly more recent than 1945, as we've heard rhetoric like this much more recently. He said, "I've often been asked what interests we have in Poland, Greece, Iran, or Korea. Well, I think we have the most important business in the world, and indeed the only business worthy of our traditions, and that is this: to do everything within our diplomatic power to foster and encourage democratic governments throughout the world. We should not be timid about blazoning to the world our desire for the right of all peoples to have a genuine civil liberty. We believe our dynamic democracy is the best in the world." Well, of course, you've heard say more rhetoric like this much more recently. But this was for Americans, it involved affairs, the public face of what they wanted with the extension of American influence. But although many observers at the time, and in writing about it subsequently about the Cold War, have talked about these two big dogs chewing on the bone, there were in fact four great powers, the so-called sort of Big Four, which also included Britain and France. Both, of course, were still major empires in 1945. Both had significant armed forces, had seats on the Council of Foreign Ministers, which was a very important council responsible for writing the post-war war peace treaties, and they also shared with America and Russia in occupying Germany, defeated Germany. So we need, in a sense, to broaden our perspective and look outside the superpowers to think of these other powers or other players in the game, because these too were influential in determining the shape of European policies, international policies, the North Atlantic Alliance, the emerging European Community. Paris, too, was an important centre for diplomacy, and this was something which was sort of French tradition, but it continued to remain the case, and it was the background for meetings of the Council of Foreign Ministers, the UN, and indeed the final European Peace Conference in 1946. So although France, and we might say perhaps Britain as well, was in a period of relative decline, and we'll talk next week about sort of imperial decline. Nonetheless, these are countries which still retain in this period a very important presence in world affairs, and also here in a kind of mapping out this the boundaries of a post-war Europe. So that's just to give a sense of where we're starting from. We're thinking about France and the international stage in 1945. So now I want to think more specifically about this relationship between France and America, which is so we'll be talking about obviously a bit more tomorrow. I don't know if any of you have visited Brest, the maritime town, important port. Here's a picture after the Allied bombing raids in 1944, as you can see, very much happened. And if any of you visited it more recently, you realise much of it is sort of 1950s concrete. The relationship of the French to their liberators was therefore a complex one. Of course, many French were euphoric, as we saw in previous weeks, to be liberated from German occupation, but this liberation had come at a great cost, as you can see here, material cost, but of course also human cost. There had been accidents. One town of Royan was accidentally destroyed when some Allied bombers dropped bombs on it when they were heading for Germany. 100,000 people were killed, non-intentional, but it was a kind of thing that was obviously likely to happen as the Allies were trying to prepare for D-Day. So on the one hand, we've got liberation parties. We've got the excitement of the American GIs and their cigarettes and nylons and etc. And then on the other hand, we have resentment at these new occupiers, the Americans, the Allies, now occupying France. And as you can imagine, tensions arise on a kind of everyday level as well as at a higher national level. And by spring 1945, you can already see graffiti in many Americans to occupy towns saying, US, go home, so the French making their opinions clear. So on the one hand, we've got very heartfelt gratitude to the liberators and recognition that you know, the cost of liberation there has to be borne. And on the other hand, we've got a population that's hungry, bereaved, doesn't want to be occupied anymore, even by the Allies, not the Germans. We've also got a population that's desperately in need of financial aid to rebuild France. We saw in that previous photograph, you know, many towns have been entirely flattened. Transport networks also need to be reconstructed. Many industrial areas particularly have borne the brunt of attacks. So France really, really needed American, particularly financial aid after the war. And this was the reason behind this Bloom Burns agreement. This press photo here, the two meeting in America to discuss how America might support France financially. And as you can see, there are benefits here, but there's also a sort of price tag attached. So what came out of this agreement was that essentially war debt was to become interest-free, very important of course, and the total was then added on, which loans that were available for reconstruction, reconstructions of infrastructure, and material rebuilding. But on the other hand, the French had to open up their market to American products, and we'll obviously be coming back to this in a bit more detail tomorrow when we think about Coca-Cola, an iconic American product, which I'll talk about also in a minute. This agreement, the Bloom-Burns Agreement, was a very significant turning point, as you see, as it brings about important economic change in the economic situation in France. But even a few years after this, it was felt that martial aid had nonetheless political connotations. It wasn't just about rebuilding, it wasn't just about the economy, it was also about politics. In theory, martial aid was even available to the Soviets because it was meant to support material recovery in any country that had been affected by the war. But in practice, the Americans looked much more favourably on applications from countries which were trying to establish a post-war democracy. And so this meant that economic financial aid could be restricted or denied to countries which were less democratic, particularly those which were being taken over by sort of single-party communist states. By 1947, because of origins of the Cold War, communists are being dismissed from governments in a number of European countries. We saw France, we already had it in France last week, but also Italy, Luxembourg, and Belgium. And although the British and the French agreed not to finalise their acceptance of martial aid before consulting with Russia, the Soviets were very clear about their disparagement of this form of American imperialism as they saw it. And they felt that acceptance of American aid signalled your position in the Cold War, your alignment with one camp or the other. So martial aid wasn't just about the economy, it was about politics as well. And here's some results from an opinion poll on martial aid, and I'll contrast Martha's with another opinion poll. So this is in France in 1952, so 20 years afterwards. 35% are in favour, 37% less favourable, 23% unfavourable or hostile, and 52% bothered either way. So certainly some very positive responses, but quite a significant minority here, 53%, a bit uncertain about accepting this aid. Obviously, there are benefits, but there seems to be too much of a price tag attached. By this point, of course, the military implications of where you stand in the Cold War are becoming clearer. And in the same year, 1952, there's another opinion poll about where the French would stand if there was an armed conflict between Russia and America, and 45% felt that France should not actually not take sides, should be neutral in such a conflict. 36% would support the USA, and only 4% would support the USSR. And it's the 4% that's interesting here, because this is a time at which communism or parties in sort of exile from government is nonetheless very, very strong in France. The Communist Party has a very high membership, more than 4% of the population. So that suggests that even members of the Communist Party wouldn't want France to fight for the USSR if there was an armed Cold War conflict. It also suggests that a large number of the French favoured non-alignment neutrality. So that's 45% felt that France should not take sides in such a conflict, which suggests that for many in France, although they certainly will not want to fight for Russia, nonetheless they're not prepared to side unilaterally with America either. So I want to think now a little bit about anti-Americanism in France, a sort of more resentful response to American dominance and to the influx of American products, like Coca-Cola, also American film, that remains a hot topic today, even though there's a proportion of American films compared with French ones shown in France. What does anti-Americanism mean? If you've looked into this in some of the secondary literature, you realise there's quite a heated debate over the very definition. Is it something cultural? Is it opposition to the sort of cultural dominance of American products, films, or literature, or TV over European or French ones? Or is it something political? Maybe the French responding negatively to McCarthyism, sort of communist witch hunting in America in the 50s. Jean-Paul Sartre once described America as having rabies, as being like this mad dog you had to keep away from. But he also said that he wasn't anti-Americanism, and he didn't know what anti-Americanism really meant. So there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what this attitude really involves, what it means, whether it's a political thing or cultural thing, or both, and that debate still continues. So what I think emerges from this is that expressions of anti-Americanism are not a kind of single phenomenon easy to define, but they share an important characteristic, which is, might be termed sort of resistance to the new dominance of America on the world stage. So whether this is political or cultural, both a sense of resistance, of wanting to maintain French values, products, traditions, whatever, against American ones. And this, in a sense, ties into a much longer-term trend of European reactions against America, something we can see well before the Second World War, particularly in the 20s and 30s, when, after its involvement in the First World War, America is becoming a greater player on the European stage. And in the late 1920s, a book was published by someone called Georges Duhamel, I don't remember his name, but he was a doctor, and he travelled to America in the 20s, and he called this book Scènes de la vie future, Scenes of Future Life, and he was, like many other European travellers to America, both kind of fascinated and horrified by the skyscrapers, by the urban culture, by what he felt was the sort of anonymity of American cities. And he was particularly concerned that he thought Europe was actually heading in the same direction, and that America thus presented this sort of distorting mirror of what Europe was going to become. And his book was widely very, very successful because a lot of people shared these fears. So what's going on in the 1950s has kind of an important prehistory, particularly in the 1930s. There's also continuity in terms of those who are expressing anti-Americanism. Here's a picture of the philosopher, in any way, Meunier, and the word that he used, which is associated briefing through it. He was a very important kind of non-conformist thinker of the 1930s who tried to think of a way between left and right for France, possibly a sort of Catholic third way. And his anti-Americanism had thus been sort of already developed before the war. But it developed slightly differently after the war, because in the 1930s it's quite interesting, sort of a Catholic solution to the left-right conflict. In Vichy, he eventually turns against the Vichy regime because he thinks it's too bourgeois. He can't stand the bourgeoisie like many non-conformists of the 30s. But after the Second World War, he becomes increasingly interested in the Soviet Union and increasingly anti-American, and his Catholicism becomes kind of eclipsed by Marxist sympathies. And in 1946, this review magazine, Esprit, devotes a whole issue to America, to Americanism, anti-Americanism, American influence. And it's, Esprit and other reviews of a similar kind thus provide a sort of forum in which intellectuals, philosophers like Meunier can discuss what they think America is, what they think America's threat is, what America represents. Newspapers also are obviously very important at forming opinions, as we saw last week when people vote according to their newspaper. And a number of the sort of important titles of this period, Le Monde, Le Temps Moderne, for example, are also voicing quite a strong anti-American line, which can sometimes seem to be quite pro-Soviet. But it wasn't maybe as simple as that. And here, Hubert Gouffe-Maurie wrote in Le Monde, the editors, but a fellow editor said of him that he's no Stalinist, so he's not actually, he might be anti-American, but not pro-Soviet. And he has the slightest sympathy for the Russian regime, further, he has an even stronger hatred for American civilization. Russia is odious, but not totally despicable. So to be anti-American didn't necessarily mean being entirely pro-Soviet. It was more a case of being, it's rather complicated, but sort of being anti-communist, so against those sort of anti-communist rather than pro-communist. So it can be more complicated than it first appears. Perhaps a more simplistic case of anti-Americanism was the opposition to what the French called colonisation, the infiltration of American products into French economy, but particularly Coca-Cola, as you see here, they were busy in French as well as in English. This becomes a kind of political battle as well as an economic one, because Coca-Cola is promoted as a capitalist drink, and certainly as a sort of non-revolutionary drink, and the American manufacturers joke that you can't really imagine revolutionaries sitting around drinking Coca-Cola. You can imagine them in some sort of smoky cafe with their vodka, but the revolutionaries don't drink Coca-Cola, therefore if you drink it you must be sort of pro-capitalist. So it becomes involved in a whole sort of political struggle, not just an economic one. And Coca-Cola is of course being marketed across Europe in this period, but there's a lot of suspicion of it in certain circles, and in Austria, communists even spread the rumour that the Coca-Cola factories are actually manufacturing atomic bombs and not Coca-Cola at all. So all sorts of wild rumours spring up about this. And at the same time, there are also economic concerns. Those who produce wine, beer, fruit juice, whatever, feel that they may be threatened by, their livelihoods may be threatened by the influx of this new drink on the market. So it even ends up being discussed in the National Assembly in France, which organises this sort of investigation to see if the drink is in fact dangerous or whether it has any health benefits. The result is that continues to be sold in France. But it becomes a sort of symbolic battle, because many French people who would, you know, without even thinking about it, buy an American fridge or buy American nylons, won't touch Coca-Cola, and it's still a sort of bone of contention in France today. I remember once going out for a drink with a French friend who now works in America and is very sort of keen on America, and I ordered a Coca-Cola, and she was absolutely horrified and said you couldn't do that because it represented the wrong kind of America. So even now it's seen as a sort of political symbol in a way. So there are different levels of anti-Americanism. There are philosophers like Emmanuel Mounier, for whom it's a sort of ideological, it's an intellectual battle. There are those for whom it's a sort of symbolic battle. They don't want to drink Coca-Cola. They're going to have their glass of, you know, Pastis 51 or whatever instead. And certainly the sort of the intellectual strain here is a minority one, but perhaps people like Mounier in their anti-Americanism are nonetheless speaking for a sort of broader group among the French who want to resist American dominance as a way of kind of fighting back, showing that France still has a place on the European stage. And I want to think a little bit about the second group of people, sort of those who, not necessarily pro-American, but recognise that it's difficult to be neutral in the Cold War, but in a sense, if you want to carry out political, economic actions, you have to take sides, you've got no choice. But in taking sides, you don't necessarily have to give up on French interests or on European interests. So I want to think a little bit about those who'd try to make a sort of European vision work as their response to France's loss of great power status in this post-war period. So I want to think first about these two here, Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman. And both were very keen on the idea of Europe, and as you know, Jean Monnet is often described as sort of the father of Europe. But they recognised that the post-war situation was a very difficult one, and even though there'd been, you know, the peace treaties, nonetheless, national differences and old feuds and quarrels don't just go away overnight. And if you want to build a new Europe, even if you're thinking mainly in economic terms, you can't neglect these sort of political conflicts. For the French, of course, the German problem, as they call it, remains a very real one in the post-war period, because France has been invaded by Germany 3 times in 70 years, and 3 times in a lifetime. So, you know, many of the French don't see any reason why another invasion might not happen, fairly soon. So there is a lot of opposition to the idea of German rearmament, which is something the Americans want, because they are a strong ally against Soviet Russia. So at the Paris conference in the end of 1945, mapping out post-war Europe, although France has accorded 20% of war reparations payments, nonetheless the French refuse further concessions to Germany. So it's not quite as bad as the Versailles Treaty, but still certainly there's a lot of resentment and suspicion. France is one of the occupying forces in Germany, but it's in a sort of subordinate position. As we've seen, the French weren't necessarily represented at these post-war, sort of international post-war talks. Jean Monnet is someone who's very keenly aware of the difficulties of the Franco-German relationship, and particularly of the situation after the First World War. And this is something that comes from his own personal experience. He began his career in the family cognac business, so he's sort of primarily a businessman, but even from a fairly early period, he becomes involved in international politics. During the First World War, he's dispatched to London by a country that he learned to work with the British in the French Liaison Committee. And then after the war, he becomes Deputy Secretary of the League of Nations, which was trying to work for the stability of Europe in that period, ultimately unsuccessfully. He also joins the Paris branch of the New York Investment Bank, so he's liaising not just with the British after the First World War, but also with Americans. And so his business interests, in a sense, make him or help him to become a kind of international player. On the eve of the Second World War, he's actually in America on a mission from the French Air Ministry trying to convince Roosevelt to expand American war production, potentially buying from France. And as France falls to Germany, he's busy negotiating with Churchill about British Union, which is obviously kind of superseded when Pétain takes power. So he's a very skilled negotiator, skilled businessman, knows how to network on an international level, but he's also, and it's very important for what he tries to achieve and what he does achieve, he's an optimist and a pragmatist. And these two things are very important in trying to build a kind of post-war Europe. And he once said to an American friend who asked him about his sort of world view, his optimism, that he'd been very struck once by reading a biography of the King of Saudi Arabia. And a Western visitor had apparently once asked this king the reason for his success. And the king had replied, well, when I was young, God appeared to me in the desert, and he said to me, for me, everything is a means to an end, even the obstacles. And this king took this vision to heart and thought, you know, I'm going to make things work. Even the obstacles can be turned to my advantage. And Monet is very struck by this, and he very much sort of adopts this approach in dealing with Europe. He also follows a Swiss writer called Agnel, don't need to remember the name, who believed in the importance of institutions over individuals. This too is also very important in creating a European community. Monet thought that individual wisdom could die with that individual, whereas accumulated wisdom was enshrined, if you like, in institutions. So it's the institutions you needed to work at building up, not just getting a sort of group of individuals together. Monet had also a great capacity for hard work, which again kind of served him well. And I think these characteristics are important because in the late 1940s, any sort of Franco-German reconciliation or even working together in an economic sense might have looked a bit foolhardy. And at this period, Monet said, he said, "I've always believed that Europe will be established through crises, and that the outcome will be the sum of the outcome of these crises." So he's prepared to work with a fairly unfavourable situation to try and create a new Europe. And he works very closely with Foreign Minister Robert Schuman, who's quite well placed as an agent of Franco-German reconciliation because he'd been a German citizen of Alsace-Lorraine, when it was under German control, and then he was a French citizen after 1919, or after 1918, when it became part of France again. And Monet's project for Franco-German working together, eventually reconciliation, is an economic one. It's to do mainly with the coal and steel industries, very important in reconstruction. But it takes the support of Schumann to kind of bring this project to fruition, because it's not very popular in French ministries. There had already been cooperation between the French and the German in the manufacture of steel, a sort of international steel cartel, and working together between different companies during the Second World War. But in 1945, all the German cartels were abolished, so this had to start from scratch. So they needed to renegotiate this sort of working relationship. And Schumann's plan for the French government, which is drafted by Monet, becomes known as the kind of Schumann Declaration, is to create a new institution that will regulate coal and steel production for France and Germany together. And he says, the French government proposes to place the whole of Franco-German coal and steel production under a common high authority, an organization open to the participation of other European countries. The pooling of coal and steel production will ensure immediately the establishment of a common basis for economic development. First step towards the destiny of these regions, so long dedicated to making the weapons of war, of which they have been the most constant victims. The interdependence of production will make all war between France and Germany not only unthinkable, but physically impossible. So a lot of things, different things going on here. On one level, this looks like kind of economic agreement. It's about reconstruction. It's about pooling resources of coal and steel. But it also has important political implications. If the French work together in this area, then they can't be creating weapons of war to use against each other. They have to cooperate. This plan is also, in its way, an attempt to move towards European, sort of greater European economic independence. As we saw, Europe, France, for example, was very dependent on America economically and financially after the war. But this sort of idea for coal and steel organization is not something that America is involved in. It's something that French and German officials are trying to work out together. So although it's not an anti-American move, nonetheless it represents an emphasis on Europe rather than on American, on European independence. Monet also hoped that it would lead to further cooperation. He thought you can't immediately ask for some sort of political cooperation between France and Germany. It's just not going to work after the Second World War. But if you start with something that might seem less political, then you could, that can be a sort of foundation stone. You can move on from there to maybe other areas of economics, and then perhaps to something political later. So there were various things going on here with this project. What then was its legacy? As I mentioned earlier, Monet is talked about as being the father of Europe. He's in 1988, his ashes were transferred to the Pantheon in Paris, which is a kind of secular equivalent of canonization. But opinions on what he actually achieved with this coal and steel community are much more mixed. People have pointed out that this community didn't really develop as he hoped it would, that Europe, as a sort of European economic community, wasn't built according to Monet's plan, and that those who, the Treaty of Rome in 1957, have set the bases for the EEC, weren't actually using this coal and steel community as a model. So perhaps it was a gesture, but not necessarily of the practical benefit that Monet had hoped it would be. Nonetheless, those who signed the Treaty of Rome had, in many cases, also signed this treaty to create a coal and steel community. And perhaps, although it's a tentative first step, at least it was a first step towards some sort of economic cooperation, even when that seemed a difficult proposition after the war. Certainly the Franco-German relationship remains very important, and it's something that de Gaulle tries to build up with the Franco-German Treaty in 1963. So perhaps Monet does leave an important legacy, even if it's maybe more symbolic than a practical one. So you could say that Monet and Schiwen, with these economic projects, were nonetheless seeking a new political role for France in Europe and a new political role for Europe against that of the United States. They were hoping that France would play a sort of special part in the creation of a new Europe by taking the initiative here to work with their old enemies, Germany. So this certainly wasn't the kind of neutrality that anti-American intellectuals would have imagined as you know, the best French response to the Cold War world, but it was nonetheless sort of trying to work within this Cold War structure to French to European advantage. So I now want to think about this third approach to France's role on the world stage, which was that of de Gaulle. And I'm sure you've all come across, here it is in translation, the very famous quotation from de Gaulle that he said, "All my life I've thought of France in a certain way, accepting de la France, inspired by sentiment as much as by reason. I have a feeling that Providence has created her either for complete success or exemplary misfortunes. If mediocrity shows in her, it strikes me as an absurd anomaly." Well, from what we've sort of touched on in terms of de Gaulle's career so far, you've probably seen examples of this certain de la France that he held, and which in itself expresses an enormous confidence and deliberate sort of self-confidence in this great role of France is going to play in Europe and in the world. So what he's also associated with is a concept of French grandeur, which is maybe partly invented, maybe being sort of delusory, but nonetheless is important in terms of building up French self-confidence about themselves as a world power. De Gaulle was a military man, as we've seen, in a very traditional mould. He grew up in a Catholic nationalist family, among those who vividly remembered the Franco-Prussian War and thus had very strong sentiments of wanting revenge on Germany. So from his sort of earliest days, he was very much imbued with a sense of the German threat to France. But he was also quite disparaging of the way in which the Third Republic saw Germany, their very defensive attitude, the fact that they created this huge kind of structure of the Maginot Line to keep the Germans out, which of course didn't work in the end anyhow because the Germans came through where they hadn't built a section of the Maginot Line. So he has a sort of residual suspicion of Germany, but he's also a pragmatist and he doesn't just believe in a sort of defensive attitude. He believes that France's role, France's greatness on the world stage needs, on the one hand, a strong national army, but on the other, an independent foreign policy. And what he really disliked was supranational institutions, the sort of coal and steel community, the Monet model. He thought these took away from national sovereignty and would make France or any other country subservient to greater powers, be they other countries or a sort of European community of some kind. So his approach to France's loss of great power status is in some ways quite different from the others we've seen, particularly different from that of Monet and the Europeanists who believed in these supranational institutions. Whereas intellectuals railed against America and created a sort of dream world of neutral France taking this third way, and whereas Monet and his associates tried to work quite pragmatically within the new Cold War framework, de Gaulle's rather personal strategy for making France's voice heard was to be very defiant and awkward on an international level, so that it would be impossible not to take notice of France, even though the reactions would not necessarily be very positive ones. His attitude angered many people, irritated them. They found him very difficult to deal with. But it did pay some dividends in terms of a revival of French confidence, which is at least partly what being a great power was him all about. We've already seen a little bit of this awkwardness in the way he behaved during the Second World War. Although he was, as we know, in London as leader of Free France, he didn't always get on very well with British authorities, made a point of not getting on very well with them. And we saw that, you know, even after liberation, even after the Allied military contribution to liberation, he decides he's not going to mention that. He's going to say, you know, French liberated themselves, which obviously isn't entirely true at all. He's also quite keen to make his voice heard when the boundaries of Europe, and particularly the boundaries of France, are being redrawn after the war, because the Allies wanted France to keep to its 1939 borders, but de Gaulle is very keen to acquire a little bit of extra territory along the Italian border. And if you ever travelled by train from Italy through to France, you'll go through various stations that look as if they must be Italian from the name, but realise you've actually crossed the French border and they're in France. Well, that's all thanks to de Gaulle, who decided he was going to really fight for these little extra bits of sort of parcels of territory on the edges of France. And as the wartime alliance between America and Russia drifted into a Cold War antipathy, de Gaulle was very concerned to maintain France's voice even within this battle that might seem to be between, as this clash between just two superpowers. And he was actually interested in the long term in the possibility of an alliance with the USSR. And he was reluctant to commit France to long-term dependence on America, which might seem surprising because he's, from a traditional anti-communist, but because he's also a pragmatist, he kind of favours the idea of a Franco-Russian relationship. Immediately after the war, of course, he doesn't have very much opportunity to pursue any of these ambitions because he sends himself off into political exile at the beginning of 1946, and doesn't return to power until 1958. He doesn't disengage himself from these wider questions, and in fact, he feels that the Fourth Republic has sort of justified all his fears because it's granted concessions on points that he would have defended, like accepting autonomy for the Ruhr, the Rhineland, which he would have wanted to keep more closely controlled by France. And he also remains aware of a sort of Soviet threat to France, and some people have suggested that he established this great party that was not a party, the RPR, as a sort of anti-Soviet bulwark, in a sense, because he thought the Fourth Republic was too weak to defend itself against the Soviets. When he comes back to power in 1958, however, he's obviously got a freer rein to develop his own vision for France, for the world, to a certain degree. And although he inherits his country's membership of certain supranational bodies, such as Euratom, for example, or also the Coal and Steel Community, he's very concerned that these institutions should not impede the expression of national sovereignty, and he's very concerned that cooperation in Europe should take place between specific governments, between specific individual leaders, and not at this higher level of these institutions. He thus has somewhat spirited confrontations with other governments and with other international bodies, and in 1965, the EEC is discussing a system of sort of compulsory majority voting in the Council of Ministers, and de Gaulle refuses to accept this requirement, and he boycotts community institutions for 6 months in what's called the crisis of the chaise vide, the empty chair, because he's simply not there. But in the end, his tactics pay off because there's a compromise is recognised whereby individual member states have the right to veto projects that seem to threaten their national sovereignty. So he's certainly prepared to make his voice heard, even though this makes the situation quite awkward. And this is something that happens again when he opposes British entry into the European Community, which he felt would totally upset the balance of Europe, because the British would bring in all sorts of cheap agricultural products, particularly New Zealand lamb, and this would kind of spoil the balance of the European economy. So de Gaulle is also trying to pursue national objectives, French great power status, but in a slightly different way from Monet or from intellectuals favouring neutralism. And I wanted just to conclude with a Gaullist, somebody who's sort of has a great personal attachment to de Gaulle, a historian, a political scientist, who's written a lot about de Gaulle, about France, French history generally, because here was somebody who tried to justify de Gaulle's policy, particularly the awkwardness of de Gaulle's policy in the 1960s, and published a number of articles, which you might interested to have a look at, in Esprit, so this intellectual journal, but also in a journal called International Organization. He's based in America at Harvard, so he was trying to justify the awkwardness of Gaullism to his American readers. And Hoffman argued that it was surely understandable that somebody like de Gaulle had experienced the humiliation of the Second World War should want his country to regain its own self-esteem, to regain its position on the world stage. But Hoffman had very personal reasons for defending de Gaulle. This wasn't just an intellectual argument. He'd been born in Vienna in the late 1920s of an American father but a Jewish mother. And he owed his survival in Vichy France to the kindness of ordinary French people, and particularly to a history teacher at his school who'd helped to forge him identity papers so he could escape. And he remembered listening to de Gaulle's great radio broadcasts during the war and gaining an enormous sense of hope from them. And at the liberation, he remembered seeing a sort of a newsreel image of de Gaulle, and later described the great enthusiasm with which this was, it's just sort of the sight on screen of de Gaulle was greeted by those in the cinema. He wrote, "The euphoria of a national general will was palpable. For the rest of my life, I was going to be stirred by the drama of peoples rising for their freedom, breaking their chains more deeply than by any other public emotion and by most private ones." As I said at the beginning, it's in some ways a very strange convention to talk about a country as having a single national will, because obviously they don't. But however strange and in some ways mythical this idea of a national will is, it's clearly very important, and as we can see for Hoffman, it was something that greatly inspired him, the idea of France being freed at the end of the war. But the idea of a national will could, of course, be used against France as well as in favour of France. The people whom Hoffman referred to as breaking their chains could be perhaps the Vietnamese, the Algerians. How would France deal with this challenge, the loss of empire? Well, that's what we'll look at next week. Thank you.